truck. Sound like a winner.
We're going to have a gal up at my wife's office. She's a Hawaiian girl.
Types 100 words a minute.
Really?
And she's going to type the manuscript.
Good.
When I finally get it done, you know, the point
is she a, must be an English type.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
she's a... Yeah, she graduated from the University of Hawaii.
Yeah? And she's way up here.
Oh, yeah. Her husband's out of Isleton.
Oh,
yeah. But anyway, she's going to type, do my manuscript type.
Yeah.
And I'll pay her so much fee. So, we were talking about Eliot.
Right. We talked about Eliot Stevenson and the 1960 May episode on the West Approach of McKinley. I mentioned Stevenson because he was one of the experts of cold weather tests. He worked closely with both the Air Force and the Army. He'd been on McKinley many expeditions. The reason they choose the high mountains is because they have the environment of cold winter, harshness all summer practically. At any rate, the very top of McKinley on the hottest day of the summer due to its 20,000 foot elevation is at least 10 below zero as the sun shines brightly, even in the day in August because of the adiabatic lapse rate, 3.5 degrees to 5.5 degrees per 1,000 feet comes 20 to 100 degrees. Less surface temperature, and you're down to 10 below zero, really. And also the chilling winds and the various currents of air and the masses of air work in a cooling manner, and the higher you go, the cooler it gets, except in the case of an inversion like Chena Ridge.
Yeah.
But anyway, in addition, the activity along the scientific routes included quite a few universities. One was Meiji University, also there in 1960. They were on an entomology, biology, and mapping mission for the Meiji University in Japan. This summer alone, I had 10 Japanese expeditions.
I think I got most of that.
Yeah, but my point was that the activities for this period of time from 51 through 71 included such as Institute of Arctic Biology, Professor Morrison's Space Age Exertion at Altitude Physiology Study. Professor Morrison was probably at the University of Alaska.
Yeah, he's still up there.
Yeah. Well, anyway, he was in charge of the exertion at altitude section, and this was the information he used directly for the benefit, if possible, for the space age effort. It got underway. It was underway in 60, but it really got underway for 3 years, 67 through 70, when they tested the various crews. They had blood centrifuges and various scientific devices to check out the chemistry of the blood at two stations, a base landing elevation, 14,003 and 73. And they found out some interesting aspects of blood chemistry, physiology, and high altitude. Anyway, this was part of the tracking contained in the years of this award, 21 years safety award at altitude, which included operations like those mentioned, plus the routes of all the other climbing expeditions, the scientific. There was cosmic ray observation Washburn conducted. They conducted these observations at high altitude scientific equipment. Now, he went in with the help of a dog team, as I recall, on one of the early cosmic ray observation missions, but later on we tested not only all the things mentioned, but also the thickness of the ice to determine if the ice was billing or receding on McKinley. And there's a scientific, very accurate description of the variation of the ice crust thickness on McKinley over a period of years. This is part of the information that came over the period of 1571, and it includes a whole lot of people that a few people have heard about, but it did include a lot of plant activity. And this is one of the reasons the award from the old CAA at that time, the government agent for civilian aviation.
When did CAA go over to FAA?
Oh, in the late 50s. But anyway, on the strength of the background, the humorous part I thought was that I'd fly that long at altitude and also supplied the 14,000 foot observatory on top of Mount Wrangell. And of course, Dr. Maynard Miller's Bering Ice Survey and all of those samples.
And
without a mark on the airplane and thousands of close calls with no catches. And then I go down here and the wind blows my plane away, so they give me this tremendous award, and 1 week later, the most valuable airplane I've ever bought.
Now, how long had you owned that 185 at that time?
Oh, let's see. About 3 months.
Is that right?
Yeah, I had $100.
What's that? Miller's
Which one? Dr. Maynard Miller? Gee, I don't know where he came from, but he's widely known.
But when I worked in the registrar's office at Michigan State, there was a guy who would come to Alaska every summer and bring the reality to the
Well, but it may be the same
Yes, but that's where he did work.
I wouldn't be
He dug a hole clear down on a glacier. They had a laboratory in the glacier.
Well, you see, the Oil Surface Geology Survey, the purpose was because this is all a sedimentary geology formation, compatible. There's anticlines, thin plains, and everything.
Well, he was studying the glacier itself, though. I don't think, of course, it may have been another research project.
He's been on the
Was he from the University of Michigan or Michigan State?
I wouldn't be a bit surprised.
Michigan State, because I knew I was working in registrar.
Yeah, I remember his name.
Credits, you know, they kids go on field trips with him in Alaska, and then they get credit.
Well, he must be the same guy.
They had an article in the Alaska Sportsman on him also with some excellent pictures. It was either Alaska Sportsman or, no, it was National Geographic.
Listen, maybe
this was 3 or 4 years ago.
If we could contact him, maybe he'd have some pictures of those flights and more accurate dates. Thank you.
Well, when did you bunch that plane on Yellow Jacket Creek?
Oh, well, this was not an expedition of glaciers. This was a hunting video. Okay, this was a big fact. That was August 63. But,
remember the exact date of the
day? Yeah, well, it was late August 63. Now, see, the sheep season usually opened in about the first part of August. Last part, I made about 8 or 9 successful flight operations from this tiny lake at 6,000 foot elevation, which is 180 Cessna, on boats. So, I had to bring out this one hunter, very light boat. I had planned on breaking the sheep hunter's boat into 2 parts. I'd bring he and the horns out, and then the camp and the sheep meet out on the second boat, which is very extremely light boat, snappy 2187
boat.
So, again, turbulence was a factor. And always in a pressure time, in this case, I've made several trips into the area and had elected not to land because of the wind. Now, on this particular afternoon, I'd gone in there, and the wind was from the left, from the south, and it was turbulent. All my other successful operations had been with no wind conditions, except on one occasion when I took off the direct hit of the tree. But anyway, the takeoff was unspectacular on the fatal last ride of particular 5.5 X-ray, the new 180 Cessna boats. And as I cleared the end of the small lake, 6,000 foot level, the turbulence gained immeasurably. And I could feel, in spite of the fact that the country was almost level, that I was losing altitude inch by inch. And the plane buffeted. And actually, what had happened, we run into a wind switch on the takeoff. And the sheep hunter recognized that. And he said, that blankety-blank wind switched on us on the takeoff. Approximately the time we got in the air, it was a quartering tailwind. And I had nose high. Normally, if you take off, you get the nose down. But in order to miss the large rocks, I was encouraged to raise the nose slightly higher. And I went between a great obstacle course, and I finally came to two rocks. So I went between the rocks, took off both floats, broke the plane off the tail. The engine went spinning 200 feet off to the right. The stumps of the wings disintegrated off the airplane. Sheep hunter, the horns, the two seats, and I wound up 60 feet deep in an ice hole, in the very bottom of this ice hole. And the first thing I said was, boy, was that noisy. And the sheep hunter said, are you all right? I said, I think so. And I wiggled around there, and neither one of us had a scratch. We chipped one, the right horn of the sheep horn.
Right. You were taking off of water on the float.
Yeah. And I got off. And I flew about 1,500 feet. And this is known as the backside of the car curve. That is, when you get the nose too high.
Too slow and not going to power left.
Right. And you lose too much elevation, too much altitude, lowering the nose. The nose is too high. You're above that 16 degrees against the relative wind, and the wing is flying in a stall configuration, in other words, and the only thing that will save you is altitude, which we didn't have. So as I lowered her inch by inch, I wiped out both floats, the tail section, the wings, the engine, the full cuisine, and the junk wound up in a hole 60 feet deep.
Wow.
And a friend of mine who we hired to fly for us came out and looked, took one sweep, and roared back into the helicopter.
He just,
I told him where you were going.
Right, but I mean, you were overdue coming back, so he came out looking for you.
It is Ramstead, the great bear hunter.
Who was it?
Stu Ramstead.
Stu Ramstead.
Yeah, the guy that had the 8 illegal bears.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Oh, he's a killer bear.
Where was he located then? Where was he based?
Well, he was flying for us out of Calpena.
Oh, I see. He was working for you.
Yeah, and he came out, took one pass, and ran for his life. He said, nobody gets out of that race. So he brought back to Calpena, sent out a helicopter. By that time, we'd walked 3,000 feet back to the lake. And they couldn't believe that we got out of that wreckage, because here it is, 2,000 feet. Start from 2,000, scattered for another 1,000 feet, the pieces of it here and there and yon.
Wow.
And the pieces, I still fly by it and ponder the pieces.
Yeah.
But anyway, the miracle of that was that nobody got clobbered yet. Oh, what a wreck. Because we hit it full bore. And hard, probably flying almost 100 miles an hour through the rock pile.
What's I know it's probably impossible to find them, but what's it like at the instant of impact when you hit that?
Noisy.
Tremendous noise.
Noise.
The What about, are you aware of you being thrown this way and that way and all this good stuff?
Knocked out or anything? No, no.
Because an automobile accident, you don't even know what's happening.
Well.
Bang, and it's over with, and all of a sudden you're laying in some position, you know.
Well,
I mean, while a plane is actually bouncing out, you're aware of the whole thing.
Yeah, I followed the thing. You see, there was a, in Pennsylvania, in 45 there was a fellow, his name was Scorchy Monroe. He was in Pensacola, Florida, for the Navy. He was the chief acrobatic flight instructor. And maybe what might help to realize your attitude was that I run an intensive course in acrobatics with Scorchy Monroe and a thing called a PT-19, a plywood low-wing airplane.
When was this, in 45?
Yeah.
This was after you were out of the service?
Yeah. I wanted to know how you do a slow roll, how you do a snap roll, inverted flight.
Was this before or after you?
During the time I was delivering the plane to Mexico.
What did you do? You just take a vacation, get down there?
No, no. He would work there at the Piper plant, Scorchy Monroe.
I see. Right.
And he.
Well, you were delivering him out of Florida.
No, no. Out of they didn't have the Florida Bureau.
Yeah, that's right. They didn't have
Lock Haven. Haven.
Lock Haven.
Yeah. Right. So anyway, I wanted to know about acrobatics.
So how'd you end up in Pensacola?
Well, but that's where that was Navy Flight Training Center.
Right.
And that's where Scorchy Monroe had been a flight instructor for the Navy.
I see.
He was, in the meanwhile, phased out of the Navy.
You weren't in Pensacola when you took the aerobatics.
He was in Lock Haven.
Oh, I see. Okay.
He was a flight instructor there.
I got you.
Acrobatics at Lock Haven. So I decided, man, you got this hotshot Navy flight instructor.
Yeah.
I'll just find out about acrobatics. So I say, as long as you weren't knocked out of your senses, you could tell what was going on. Same way when I lost the wing at 1,500 feet on the way into Anchorage with the load of, on my way in for a load of booze. And that was 50. When I was flying along in this PA-14 and quite fragile, and run into tremendous turbulence 15 miles north of Anchorage, and I noticed the controls acting strange, and I looked out and I heard this tearing, ripping noise. Rear spar pulled out of the left wing, and the rear edge of the wing was lifting. And it lifted up about 8 or 9 inches, and the wing swung back over the tail of the airplane, and the ball game was over. Down I came, 1,500 feet. And I found out that the only way I could keep the thing straight was to point it straight down.
No, we got that one. Okay.
Yeah, but I say,
this was a PA-14.
Well, in 50, we're talking about
right,
the wing fit.
Yeah, I know. I've got that whole
story. They marvel at the fact that a guy was able to live through that deal.
Yeah, I know. Written up for it.
Yeah. But anyway, as the thing, I know, it's angle of negative, but it's straight down. But you've only got 50 feet. This I found out in the course of acrobatics with Scorchy Monroe in Pennsylvania in 45. But these things help, because I didn't try to. I just pointed it straight down. Figured out that when I was about to go straight into the ground, I would lift the nose, and I was on skis, hopefully, from the east heading, I would wind up on our west heading, maybe. But maybe I could slide it in on the swamp. But it snap rolled into this tremendous growth of pine trees 100 feet high, which was a good deal, because it took up the shock. But anyway, what else?
Took some aerobatics, though.
Yeah.
I don't know, Don. I think that's about it, really. I haven't got anything else on my list here. I'm going to keep plugging away. I tell you what, let's do on this on this manuscript stuff now.
Calling bull moose has long been a very effective method of hunting. In Alaska, unfortunately, bulls cannot be hunted except in certain areas north of the Yukon River during the peak of the rut period, which normally occurs during October. Moose do, however, begin to rut during the last week or 10 days of September, especially north of the Yukon River, and can be hunted by calling with fair success. This tape will consist of a segment of actual moose vocalization recorded on the Kenai Moose Range by my good friend, Dr. Peter Lent of the Department of Fisheries and Wildlife at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. This to be followed by interviews with people who practice moose calling with an attempt to describe the practice and on a usable basis. The following sounds were produced by moose during the rut period. With one exception, all of the high-pitched, prolonged grunting sequences were produced by cow moose. The gluck sounds that occur were bulls calling, and this particular short gulping call seems to be the most prominent of all bull sounds when bulls vocalize. The sounds are often accompanied by raking the antlers over willows and brush. The sounds of Alaskan moose.
Mm-hmm.